Any questions from last time? Today we're starting with the action principle for field theories. So it's a change of topic. So if you have questions about what we did last week, this is a good. Nothing too urgent. Okay. So then we start with the.
Sorry, Aldo.
Yes.
Can I ask a question about? Mm-hmm. So we introduced last week three propagators, right? Three different propagators: mm-hmm. the retarded, advanced, and the final one. So we used, if I remember correctly, if we know the initial conditions. Mm-hmm. So if we have an IVP, then we use the retarded potential to find the future evolution, right? If we have final value problem, then advanced. Mm-hmm. When do we use the Feynman propagator? Why is that?
If you didn't hear, so Marco was saying we've seen three types of propagators last week. These are particular kind of Green's functions that satisfy specific boundary conditions. So we have the retarded and the advanced one, and then I also introduced the Feynman one. The retarded is useful when you know the initial conditions and then you want to evolve your field towards the future. Vice versa, the advanced one is useful for the opposite problem when you know the final condition and you want to evolve it backwards in a sense. Now he was asking, when do we use the Feynman one? So the Feynman boundary conditions are a little peculiar. They tell you that the frequencies of the field, so in Fourier transform, the time component of the Fourier transform, so the frequency of the field, is positive in the future and negative in the past. So I'm not quite sure which boundary value problem this is useful for. However, it appears the Feynman propagator plays a fundamental role in quantum field theory when you compute scattering amplitudes, or in general, you try to compute your path integral perturbatively. And that's the right propagator that one should use. Now, I introduced it from a purely classical perspective without mentioning path integral. So it was more a curiosity in a way, the way I introduced it. So it will be introduced from the quantum perspective in the quantum field theory course. And there you should see why this is the right one. I haven't said why this is the right one to use it because there's more. So one nice property that it has that I mentioned is that it's time reversal symmetric. So, whereas the other two clearly are not. They're mapped one into the other. Okay. Anything else? Okay, so today we do Lagrangian field theory. So the goal of these and the next lecture is to do in field theory what we did for particle mechanics. I will not go nearly to as much to the same level of details because things are quite more complicated in field theory. So we'll stay a bit more work without the same amount of details. But still, I want to draw parallels. We will do the equations of motion, the Noether theorem, and see in particular what the Noether theorem for space-time translations will give us. So in this case, we'll get the stress-energy tensor and its conservations. That's a goal for the day. So we start with the space-time setup. So we will work in Minkowski, and in particular, the space-time manifold we're interested in is a subspace of Minkowski, which has this form, which is a subset of 3, 1, 4. So we have R4, and we think of it as being foliated by R3 planes. So there is the one at time t1, the one at time t0, and so on. So this is m in between these two planes, and this is my time axis R. I don't know if I will truly need it, but if we have a generic surface here, okay, this is confusing because this is M in between. This generic hypersurface, I want to call it sigma T, which is R3 at the specific time. Okay, so this is anything, any surface in between. And M is a four-dimensional space in between these two, the initial and final surfaces. Then it's useful to remember that we have an outgoing normal, so N mu outgoing unit normal at the boundary of M, of the region we are interested in. So this will look, this will be future pointing at T1 and past pointing at T0. So here, one possible remark is that to do this type of, here what I'm doing is in particular breaking Lorentz symmetry, because I'm fixing a time and choosing an initial surface and a final surface. So this is, this breaks our freedom to do Lorentz transformations, because we're picking frames, we're picking a particular Lorentz frame. And this is a little like having to choose an initial and final time to talk about the action principle in particle mechanics. It's a choice, but it doesn't mean that we cannot have time translation invariant. So it's not that we are completely losing Lorentz symmetry. I just want to point out that one has to start with some choice, and this is a way to do it. Now, today I will work almost exclusively with the scalar field. We will do the Maxwell field in the tutorial and maybe tomorrow. I will just mention the Maxwell field as an example at a couple moments. So the scalar field is a map from M, or from actually Minkowski to the real number. If it's a complex scalar field, this would be, D could be C, for example. This is a real scalar field, and this is a complex. So the name scalar refers to the fact that it's about how this field transforms under a Lorentz transformation. Transformation property under a Lorentz transformation. So what is this property? A Lorentz transformation, in fact, one should say under Poincaré, including Lorentz and translations. Transformations. So we take, so this is given by some lambda. The Lorentz transformation is given by some lambda, and the translation mu nu. And the translation is given by some vector a mu, which are all constants over spacetime. So this type of transformation sends our field, our map from Minkowski to R to a new map. And what is the properties of this new map is that phi prime evaluated at x is equal to the old one evaluated at a different point related by the transformation. So another way of saying this is that the new map at the new point is equal to the old map at the old point. I prefer these because, as usual, we are looking at variations of the field, keeping the argument fixed. But these two are completely equivalent. I will come back to this point when we do the Noether theorem. Then we take variations, and we want the variation of the field, not the variation of the base point. Now, this is not the only possibility. Suppose we have the covector field of Maxwell theory. So this is a remark. This is not always the case that things are this simple. One could have a vector field a mu, and then this one is sent by the same transformation to a new vector field a mu, such that a mu evaluated at x is equal to the transform minus one x. So the argument is the same thing, is the same story about the argument. What changes is the fact that since this has an index, which is a vector index, this we should take care of transforming that part of the field too. So the field rotates with us. So this is nothing too fancy. It's just is the same thing, same as take the vector field. How does it rotate under a rotation R? You have to rotate the vector field, and also E prime at x. Here you will have the same formula. It's a rotated vector field evaluated so it's just the fact that this is a bunch of vector fields that also have to transform under your rotation. So you've already seen it. I'm just writing it in the Lorentz covariant form. Does this make sense to everybody? So this is a scalar. It's like the Coulomb potential. If I do rotations, there is no internal index to transform. Whereas if I have a vector field, a mu, it's more like an electric field that also rotates the direction in which it's pointing when I do a rotation. And this is the same for the Lorentz transformation for it. So scalar refers to the fact that there's nothing to transform outside the argument. This is what scalar means. Now I want to draw a comparison of this setup with the particle mechanic case. So we have let's see how much of the blackboard I will need. So we have n. I will write this horizontally. If you're copying it, it's better if you write it vertically. N particle. So it's a table. I will put n particle mechanics in one row and scalar field theory or field theory in another row. And the columns will be different quantities of interest. So the first one is, what is our independent variable? So the independent variable for in the particle mechanics case is time. So we could say, in fact, a bit more precisely, T0 to T1 in the action principle, we take an interval, and this is R, and this is time. In this case, the argument is not quite T, it's this X. So this will be spacetime. So we have our M, which is T0, T1 cross R3. Inside Minkowski, and this is spacetime. Next, we have spoken about the source of that map. So this is the source. Now we need to think about the target of that map, which is what we called configuration space. This is the target, so this we used to call Q. So Q in the particle case is what? We have one particle moves in R3, so the target space will be R3, but we have n of them, so it is R3, n copies of R3. So we could say, let's see. And so a point in here, we were calling it qi, and maybe we put an alpha, where the alpha I goes from 1 to 3, and alpha goes from 1 to n. So this is which particle I'm looking at, and this is where it is. Now here, in this case, we have, for the scalar field, Q is just R. It's just where this value takes place, or maybe C in the case of a complex scalar field. And I will call this symbolically still Q, if I need to refer to it. Now we have maybe a vector field, scalar field, vector field. In this case, the vector, the target space is R4, or if you want, R13, in the sense that, but let's not get, it carries a signature, but it's R4, and in this case, remember, was the case of the vector potential A mu. It has these four indices. The mu index over there is valued in R4. Next, now we have the source, the target, we can talk about histories. The histories are maps from source into the target. So we were calling them gamma from R to Q. And this sends T to Q I alpha, which is gamma I alpha T. And here, what we are calling this thing is phi, which goes from Minkowski into Q, which is still, so here Q was R3 to the n, and here is just R. for example, and it sends x into a particular value of the field at that point. Of course, for the vector field over here, we have A that sends a point in R13 in a point Q of R4, which is X is sent to, well, in this case, we have K mu, which is A mu at X. So if we want to keep this analogy, well, this parallel of the two cases. Now, once we have the history, we have configuration space to build the Lagrangian, we also need velocities. So this is the trickier one. So here we have first derivative. Let me call it this way. So here we have the velocity, and the velocity is an element of the tangent space at a certain point. But once we have a history, the velocity of the history is simply dt of gamma at a certain time. Now we want to do the same in field theory. So this is called the first jet. And the symbol will be, instead of TQ, the symbol will be J1 of Q. But not quite. So, well, maybe let's leave it. Just let's not give it a name. We just call it first jet. Because there's a subtlety in the notation that I don't want to get into. Now, what is it? So here we are taking a derivative in our independent variable of our history. But now we have many independent variables, one in each direction. So in this case, we need to talk about v mu, which is d mu of x phi at x. Or, so this is the scalar case. And if we have the vector case, we will have a v mu nu, which is d mu of a nu x. But the important point is that this is the analog of that. And this one is the analog of, well,
maybe I should do it like this.
So when the point is that here I can take first derivative in only one direction. There's only time in which I can derive, whereas here I can check how the field is changing in all possible space-time directions. Very good. Then we're ready to talk about the Lagrangian. A Lagrangian is a map L from, okay, so we see that this is sending Q, V, and T into R. So in L, well, this is just a number that we are going to integrate. And in a typical example is, so maybe I should, we called it L like this. Apologies. So an example of L would be, the typical one is 1/2 m v squared minus V of Q. Here we do something similar. We take L, and this is we have Q, we have V, we have X, and we send it into something of Q V T. So here, for now, we also think of this as R, but the important thing is this is a scalar, in the same sense as this is a scalar that does not transform. Well, it transforms invariantly under Lorentz, but otherwise you would have issues with Lorentz invariants. If you want it to be a Lorentz invariant theory, this has to be a scalar. So this is what is called the first, let's leave it. Okay, sorry about that. Now, the example is very similar. So we have L, in this case, is minus, just a second, V mu, minus V of Q, yeah? Yes?
Are we not supposed to have the Lagrangian as function of this?
Yeah. So I'm calling since this is target, I will. So for now, when I write the action, I will take one of the histories and evaluate it on a history. And another example in the case of the vector. Of the vector case, maybe I will not give an example because otherwise I have to introduce too many things. But so this is the scalar case. The vector case, vector C tutorial and tomorrow. Okay, I continue. And now we have the action. The action, we take S of a history. So this is a history. And we integrate it from T0 to T1. Dt, and we integrate our Lagrangian L, evaluated at what? At history gamma at t. Then we take, instead of the velocity, we plug in the value of the velocity, which is dt of gamma, and this can still depend on t. Functional. And here we do the same thing. We take a field history phi, and we integrate it over m d4 now of x, and we have L of phi d mu phi and x. So you probably are not used to these two blocks written like this, but the final result should be familiar. I've just introduced, as I did for particles, this notion of the velocity as independent objects. And here they're just called for strat because they have to account for different directions. But it's the same concept, in fact. There's no. What is the action principle? The action principle tells us that delta S at a solution gamma bar is equal to 0 with the variation of these at t0 and t1 being 0. So we look at all the possible histories at fixed boundary condition in gamma, and here we do the same thing. So we say delta S at phi bar, where phi bar is a particular solution, is equal to 0. But now we need to keep delta phi fixed. Oh, sorry, not delta gamma bar. Delta gamma and delta phi should be 0 at the boundary of M. And this condition is the same as saying that delta phi of t0 x is equal to delta phi of t1 x is equal to 0. Right? So these, we fix the time, but the space point where we evaluate it is free because it can be anywhere on one of those hypersurfaces. Of course, it's not that whatever Lagrangian I write, the action principle is well defined. We saw this in the tutorial. Same thing is true here. We need to check that this action, when we integrate by parts and do and so on and so forth, we are left with the term proportional to delta phi to see that this is right. If it is of this form, it will work. Okay, so this this concludes. Well, I could go on with the Euler-Lagrange equation, but I prefer to do them a bit more slowly. So instead of putting them in the table, we actually do the computation. Yes?
The vector field there in the remark, should it be lambda and then the vector field itself transform as lambda?
So here I'm working with a change in the basis and not the change.
No, I'm saying that the vector field will transform inversely to the
Let me double check. I had checked this because I needed it in a computation to be right. So let me just double check the notes. I think it was correct the way I wrote. No, I think you're right. Sorry, you're right. You're right. Yes, sorry about that. So this is the same, thank you. This is the same as says that A prime mu at X prime, which is lambda x plus a, so same here, same thing here, is equal to lambda, yeah, they need to transform oppositely, you're right, yes. Sorry about that. So this is probably, so E in the transformed is equal to R. To correct something in the, I think, yeah, there is a, oops, a mismatch between two parts of the notes. Well, no, it's not this one, it's this one. Okay, so now we do the Euler-Lagrange equations. Oops. So here this is the usual thing. We start from the action principle, and we translate it into local equations for the history. So we want to implement the idea that delta S of phi bar is equal to 0 with delta phi at the boundary is equal to zero. Now, we need to compute these objects. So what this in fact means is that if we start with the history phi of x and we vary it to phi of x plus epsilon delta phi, with delta phi vanishing at the boundary, then we compute s f phi plus epsilon delta phi. And this is the integral over m d4 l at phi plus epsilon delta phi d partial phi plus epsilon partial delta phi. Right, we're just deriving our new history, which is, so this will derive that one, and then there is x. Now we develop this, and we say that this is the original action. So this is s at phi plus epsilon, and now we compute the first order variation of this. This will be the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to the configuration variable evaluated at phi, partial phi, and x. So this is extremely redundant, of course. It is a very heavy notation, but let's be clear. So here, L is defined over those variables and then is evaluated on a history. So we take L divided by Q and then evaluated, derived in Q and then evaluated on a history. And this is multiplied by delta phi. Then there is the variation of the velocity. So here we get, which is the first jet in this case. So we get this evaluated again at phi, d phi, and x. And this is the change in the first jet in over here. And so we get d mu delta phi, and then whatever else will be higher order. So here we get s of phi plus epsilon m d4x. So here, what do we do? As usual, we want to integrate this by part and leave out a delta phi, so we get dl over dq evaluated at et cetera, minus d mu. So what does this mean? This means dx over dx mu, dl over dv mu evaluated at on the history times delta phi plus order epsilon. Oh, sorry, plus the boundary term. So here we have the boundary term at delta m. And delta m, remember, are those two hypersurfaces, the initial and the final. So here we get an integral over just 3x, the vector d3x of dl over dv mu. Oops, sorry. We get n mu with the index down. D over dv mu evaluated on the history times delta phi, and then we get higher orders in epsilon. So these are, of course, our Euler-Lagrange equations, and this boundary term vanishes because of boundary conditions, because this is delta phi evaluated at the boundary. So we get boundary term vanishes because of boundary conditions delta phi at delta m is zero as usual, and the bulk term is what gives us delta s, is the integral over d4x of dl over d phi. Now I use the more shorthand notation. Delta phi. And these are the setting these to zero will give us the Euler Lagrange equation. This is arbitrary, and this is zero. So here I use this shorthand notation. Instead of deriving by q, I just call it phi. Instead of writing v mu and then evaluating, I just say that I'm deriving by d mu phi. But that's a shorthand notation for this bracket here. So these are our Euler Lagrange. So this is implicitly sum over all mu's, of course. Good. One possible remark is that if you remember, this was defining our momenta, this piece, this boundary piece. If we throw it away because it's multiplied by something that goes to zero, but it was useful doing the Hamiltonian analysis to give to this object a name, which was the momentum. We will not do the Hamiltonian analysis of a field theory. It's in the lecture notes if you're interested. But this is what would be the momentum of the scalar field. Let's do a concrete example over here. Are there questions about the Euler Lagrange? Okay. So let's take our simple Lagrangian, which is the same that I wrote there. Now I write it evaluated on a history, so it's d mu phi, d mu phi, but it's the same one as I wrote up there. So now we compute the Euler Lagrange equation. And we get dl over d phi minus d mu dl over d mu phi is equal to what? Well, here, these are the velocities, so I leave them alone. I just look at v phi. And so we get minus, this is v prime of phi. It's just about deriving these in Q and evaluated at our point. Maybe I'll go slower. Let's go a bit slower. So I make these points a bit more explicit. So here, remember Q is in R because it's our target, and this V mu is essentially in R4, but is our first jet configuration and first jet. Now the action for this is the integral in D4x of minus 1/2 d mu phi. Oh, here, what do I mean by this contraction? I should be maybe a bit more explicit. It's like that, of course. So eta mu nu d mu phi evaluated at x minus v of phi of x. So this is the step from QVNX, and what I mean by the evaluation on a history. Next, the Euler Lagrange. So I do dl over dq and evaluate it at phi d delta phi nx. And this will be this is what? This does not depend on q, it's just that one. So this is minus v prime of q evaluated at phi d phi nx. So this is minus v prime of phi of x. But this is a real function, right? It's just a v of something valued in R. So it's just a real function. Then I do dl over d v mu and evaluate it at my history. And this is minus 1/2. I look at it here. And there are two mu, so I get rid of the 1/2, and I get mu nu, d nu, sorry, my bad, d habit, v nu. And then I evaluate it, and this will be minus eta mu nu, d mu phi, evaluated at x. So these are the two pieces over here, and now I have to take the sum of those. Therefore, 0, we get minus v prime phi of x minus d mu of eta mu nu d nu phi of x. This is our Euler Lagrange equation, which can of course be written more compactly, which is the same of box phi at x. There is a minus sign here, which I forgot to write. So this is plus. So this becomes box of f minus v prime of phi. So this Lagrangian over here, which is a pretty typical scalar Lagrangian, gives us this equation. Now, if we were to do a particle mechanic problem, what would we call a vacuum? A vacuum would be an equilibrium position, and on top of this equilibrium position, we would start doing perturbation theory, looking at small oscillations and things like this. So we can write our function v. Let's say it has a shape like that. So this is R, this is Q, which is nothing else than R in our case. So this is the shape of our potential. And so if we want, so these points over here have special properties. These three points have special properties. What happens is that v prime is equal to 0. So phi equal constant will be a solution of this. So let's say Q, let's call this Q0, Q1, and Q2. So V prime of Q0 is equal to V prime at Q1, which is the same as, and they're all 0. Therefore, box phi of x equal q0, q1, or q2 which are constants, is a solution. This is, Q2 is unstable,
of course,
under perturbations. Q2 unstable, so not interesting. Q0 and Q1 are stable, are minima, if you want, are minima and therefore are stable. I put it in quotes. I can say stable under small perturbations, where small, of course, has to be quantified, but and around these points, what I can do is to, and therefore I give them a name, and this name will be vacua. I call these configurations phi of x equal q0, q1. So q0 is the true vacuum of this potential because it's the absolute minimum. So this is the true vacuum. True vacuum, and this is the absolute minimum. I cannot go anywhere lower than that. And Q1 is a false vacuum, which is a local minimum. But in any case, they're both vacua. And vacua means that I can do perturbation theory around them. Of course, if the perturbation is too big, from the local minimum, I eventually end into the absolute minimum, or quantum mechanically, I can tunnel. So this is about vacuum tunneling. I refer you to Ruth Gregory course in January. On gravitational physics. She will discuss this situation. So quantum mechanically, of course, I can just use quantum fluctuations to jump over the barrier in some sense. It will become the more and more rare, the higher the barrier, but I can still transition. Now the question is, since we can do perturbations theory around this vacua, how does it look? So let's say, I could choose either Q0 or Q1. I just choose Q0, but if I call phi of x, zero, and I say that this is small, then V at phi of x will be V at Q0, so let's call it V0. Plus 1/2 m square. Oh, so this is V Q0 and V second Q1 are of course positive. This is kind of the point of the minimum condition. So this is phi square plus 1/3 lambda phi cube, etc., where these become less and less important. Because of the minimum condition, this quantity will be positive. This is kind of the point. And these quantities as the interpretation of the mass. The mass of this perturbation around this vacuum.
Called mass because it's like related to some energy density of the field.
I would refer you to the quantum field theory course. Gang will actually go in great details about. So in fact, the quantum field theory course will not start from fields. We start from the notion of particles. And then build fields out of creation and annihilation operators for particles, quantum field, of course. And then you will see that if you want to write a Lagrangian for these particles, you will get something like this. And that M will have the interpretation of the mass of the particle. But it's a concept that you started from, not that you get out. So if you do scattering theory from a theory built like this, this will be the mass. I'm a bit dodging the question, but I think it's maybe a better way to think about it rather than trying to reconstruct why this is. And the Euler-Lagrange equation. Then we will read something like this. I will be box of little phi plus or minus m square of phi is equal to lambda phi square plus stuff. So this is the linear part of my equations of motion. So this is the Klein-Gordon operator, box minus m square. And on the right-hand side, I have the self-interaction, which are the nonlinear terms. So this is the part that gives me the free propagation of a particle of mass m. And this one is the self-interaction of the field with itself. And this is the part that one says is small. Usually one takes lambda to be much smaller than m and do perturbation in that parameter. Yep.
I have two questions. So first is in the potential V for the perturbation field, Will it be 1 over 3 factorial or just 1 over
3? If I put 3 factorial, it's arbitrary in the sense that I can, depends what I mean by lambda, right?
Oh, okay.
I just like to have just lambda on the right-hand side of that and not lambda over 2. But
And are we calling the minima vacuum because it can be thought of as the ground state of some harmonic oscillator?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. So if I have to quantize this, perturbatively, I would have the phi can be quantized, morally speaking, as a many harmonic oscillator at each point in space-time. And this would be the free field. I can use creation and annihilation operators to quantize the left-hand side. And then I treat the right-hand side perturbatively as something that creates or destroys these particles locally. But yes, so that's very locally looks like an harmonic oscillator. If this was a parabola, it would be a free field. And all the pieces, lambda and so on and so forth, that follow will be how the field interacts with itself. So if I have a wave, instead of propagating nicely without changing shape, this wave will interact with its own energy and kind of spread or coalesce and so on and so forth. So two waves, instead of going past each other, they would interact and something new would come out. So that allows to organize this type of computation perturbatively. Good. So yeah, to solve that equation, you can go in Fourier, like we did for the propagators, in fact. You can build massive propagators. We solved the Green's function for the box. One can solve for the Green's function of box minus m squared, right? And then do a similar game for the massive theory instead of the massless one, like the photons. It's a bit more complicated, but the logic does not really change. Good. Would like to now, well, any other question before?
So if I neglect this self-interaction, I essentially just get like the Klein-Gordon operator on phi. Mm-hmm. When I go to momentum space, I get something that like it's like k squared equals m squared or something.
Yeah.
So sort of like an on-shell deformation. But then I'm sort of thinking, if I have an on-shell deformation, should I have like a continuous family of vacua?
Why? No, I don't think I. So that condition, if you have an exactly parabolic potential with the minimum somewhere, it's telling you that you are dealing with a free field that satisfies a linear wave equation, and that in Fourier, these will only carry momenta. Four momenta, which satisfy the mass shell condition. So, okay, maybe we can do this. So, let's focus on this piece, and say, I look it in Fourier. So, phi of x is the Fourier transform of e to the I px p mu x mu of something that depends on I'm calling it k, let's call it p, of p. And this equation becomes minus p squared minus m squared are my signs right? Yes, equals zero. So it means that this phi is supported only on not every four momenta would contribute to the Fourier transform of x, but only the four momenta that satisfy p squared equal m squared would contribute. So in a way, we are saying that these are on shell. This is an on-shell condition for the momentum of the four particles. So these wave vectors should be of the right mass. But this is not telling me that these are the wave packets on top of this vacuum. It's not telling me that there is a vacuum nearby. You would have a vacuum nearby if Or maybe there is a vacuum nearby, which is the specially translated vacuum. But I suspect that's maybe what you have in mind because you're. But we can discuss later. I think it's a bit of maybe slightly confusing way of looking at it. I might not be wrong, but I suspect might not give the right physics intuition. Because we want to, in any case. But that's the usual way one thinks, and this is because one can interpret this P as the four momentum of the particles described by this field in some sense. This is their mass, and this is again why this is called the mass. But I'm not telling you why that's a good way of thinking about the four momentum of the particle. So again, I'm a little cheaty. Now I would like to introduce another theorem. So for this, I introduce a new notation, which, because I want to deal with all types of fields that I can have in together. So I just call this big I is whatever other index I have for my fields. So here I have none. So I is not there. Here would be mu. Does this make sense? I'm just saying whichever extra index I have, I will call it I and trail it along without thinking too much about it. Now you remember when we when we studied Noether theorem, we had our, this is the analog of QI, if you want. QI alpha or something like that. So we had this map S that was taking Q, V, and X and sending it to something. And then we were using this to build a variation of a field. Phi of x, d mu of x, d mu phi of x, and x. So this was like, this is just the same idea that we used in particle mechanics. So we have a variation of the field that depends on which field I'm looking at. So it's the same that we did before. And as before, we say that this is an infinitesimal symmetry. If and only if delta L under this transformation is a total derivative. And here there could be really even more derivatives that appear. It doesn't really matter. I just care that this is a total derivative. What I mean by this, I mean this is like d over dt, not the partial derivative. This is deriving everything. Does that, do you remember? So this is equal to d mu, sorry, I need an index here. D mu r mu plus d mu phi dr mu over d phi plus d mu d nu phi over dr mu d over d nu phi, etc. This is the total derivative in the x direction. So this is saying, this is the same as saying if and only if action is invariant up to a boundary term. So because our Lagrangian under this transformation changes by a total derivative. So the action changes by a boundary term, by the divergence theorem. So this is a total divergence. It's also useful, well, let's, I'll do it later. It doesn't really matter for now. What do I want to keep? Not really anything. Can just. Now the Noether theorem tells us. Well, let's introduce it here as well. The Noether current. Is in this case J mu of S is equal to the sum over I of D L over D D mu phi I D S phi I. Oh, I forgot to carry on the I's, but it's. Ds phi I minus Rs mu. And this is also, of course, of phi, d phi, etc., etc. So if you remember, this is defined exactly as in the particle case, except that here, instead of deriving, putting dl over the derivative of the velocity, I have to put the full thing and then sum over mu. Well, I have an index mu hanging around. So this object is sometimes called p mu I, so that for brevity, to make it short. Now we can state Noether theorem. Noether theorem says that if delta S phi is a symmetry, an infinitesimal symmetry, like the one before, then what do we have? We have the d over dx mu of j mu s is equal to 0 on shell. And this implies, and therefore, and moreover, well, it's just a simple consequence, the charge QST, which is the integral. You remember, this is a continuity equation. It looks exactly like the conservation of the electric charge, given the four current. We don't care where this J comes from. This is just the four divergence of a four current. So we get the conservation of the charge if this divergence is zero. And this charge looks like the integral over space of the time component of our current. So this is conserved. And QS is conserved. And being conserved means that its derivative with respect to time is zero or doesn't depend on t. So this is, of course, this is a consequence of that from the continuity equation. Nothing different than in electromagnetism. How do we prove this? We prove this exactly as we prove it in the particle case. We write delta L in two possible ways. We have d over dx mu r s mu on one side, this is of shell without using the equations of motion, and then I write this as dl over d phi delta phi minus dl over d mu phi, d mu delta phi. This is using the equations of motion, but this is also, this is not using the equations of motion. Then I can write this as the sum over two terms, one that looks like, there was a plus, the equations of motion piece. But then I have to add a boundary term, a total, a total derivative here of dl over d mu phi delta phi. And now since this is zero, comparing these two, what I find is that d over dx mu of this minus that. So remember, this is just p mu delta phi minus rs is equal to equations of motion, which vanishes on shell. So the proof is identical to the other case. I apologize about the confusion between this type of derivative and that. In this case, they should be the same. It's just the habit of writing this type of derivative in this type of equation, but it should be everywhere the same. Because I'm deriving everything on the right. It's an integration by parts, so it should be done with respect to the total derivative. So this was a notational problem, not really a conceptual problem. That's why I corrected it on the fly. Okay. There are some subtleties coming in from the field theoretical Noether theorem that are not really visible or not very important, let's say, in the particle case. Are there questions about this? Yes.
In order for Q to be conserved, should we assume that like divergence of the like current is zero?
This is a
current vanishes at infinity.
Okay, very good. Let's look at the second part. Yes, we should. So so this is part one. Part two is d over dt of qs of t. This is the integral over of d of 3x of the dt of j mu, of 0. So this is the derivative over dx0 of this that depends now I look at it as a function of t and x. I forget about where it comes from, the phis. The phis have been fixed. I'm looking at one solution, so I look at it as a function of x0 and x vector. And now this is at the fixed time t, but this is equal to dtra x. And because of the continuity equation, this becomes minus d over dxi ji of x. And what I'm saying here is that this is a total divergence with respect to this 3D slice. So this is equal to an integral at infinity of si ji. And I'm saying that this is 0 because I'm assuming, as Yaroslav is saying, that the current vanishes the fields in general rapidly enough at infinity. So if I go out to infinity, nothing should happen there. It's so far away. We don't see it. This is, of course, there are subtleties usually when one does these things, but it's in many situations, it's a totally appropriate thing to do. Okay? So we are working in the lab. Everything is happening here in our box. Out behind Jupiter, nothing is happening. They know nothing about our experiment, so we are happy to put a zero on the right hand side here. That's the idea. Okay. Okay, I will not be able to do the theorem for translations. Or give examples, unfortunately, let me give you a simple example, because I don't want to leave it hanging as a super theoretical thing that doesn't look like much. I want to give one application. And then tomorrow I'll come back to what is special about this compared to the particle case. Where do I have it? Here. So let's go example. So consider a complex scalar field. So phi goes from M to C. And consider with Lagrangian, L is equal to minus 1/2 d mu phi star d mu phi star minus something that depends on the product phi star phi, which is real. So no star here, of course. So this should be a real Lagrangian, right? So we have phi star phi. So, and this is also, in fact, there's no 1/2. My apology, there's no 1/2. So this will be the same. Well, let's leave it like this. It's right. So this is, I can think of it as a function of both phi and phi complex conjugate. Or if I like, I can think of it as a function it's a bit like doing complex analysis. So I can think of these as having a scalar field which has two components, a real part and an imaginary part, or as having two scalar fields which are n phi star So either I have two components like these, or I consider these two as independent, like z and z bar when we do complex analysis. So the equations of motion, I can compute them. I choose to use these variables. You can do the exercise of rewriting it in terms of the real and imaginary parts, but I want to so equations of motion for phi bar, for phi star, is I take derivatives with respect to phi star, so I get box phi minus m square. Let me do a slight change on this, just to, I want to keep the mass term outside from my potential. So the potential is just cubic, quartic, and so on and so forth. But I extract the mass potential, the mass term. And for phi, we get the complex conjugate. So if you vary in phi star, you get d mu of this, which is the box, and then m square phi, the derivative of this divided by the derivative of the argument with respect to phi star, which is phi. Now, which symmetry can we think of this, that this action has? Well, the obvious symmetry is phi goes to e to the alpha phi. Now, what is the infinitesimal version of this? Is equal to I epsilon phi, and delta s phi star goes to minus alpha epsilon. Without the epsilon, of course. Okay. Then you can check easily, since this is a real thing, that delta S of L is equal to zero, which implies that we can fix this to zero. And now if you look at this current associated to this symmetry will be pi mu delta S. Well, let's write it. This will be dl over d. d mu phi delta s phi plus dl over d mu phi star. So if you look at what comes out of these, you get this formula. The imaginary part of this. And it's not hard to, and I leave you as an exercise to check that d mu j mu is zero on shell. So if you take the divergence of these and use these equations, this will go to zero. This will give you zero. And it gives you zero because there is this imaginary part that kills these two pieces, which will be real. Right? So this is have one line computation, so that's why. So this type of currents, you will see them popping up everywhere. I leave it here. Yeah.
Why is it that you can treat psi and psi conjugate as independent fields?
Well, it's like in complex analysis that you can, instead of using x and y, you can use z and z bar as independent objects and take these complex derivatives with respect to them, and it is the same thing. You can do the same analysis using the real and imaginary part, and you would find the same final result. We can do it together. I'm happy to go through it.
I feel like this issue of like fields having to vanish at infinity is like a very Lorentzian thing, because if I like, I'm like a Euclidean field theory, I could perhaps like relate it by like spheres, like the space-time, and they have like no boundary, so.
Yeah, it, here is also because I want to use Minkowski as my menu, as my space-time. If I allow myself to use a space-time which is S3, so three spheres times time, I wouldn't have this problem of dealing with infinities. So it's really because I'm trying to work in a Lorentz invariant theory where my space-time is flat and there's no problem. But if I add some structure and allow myself a bit more freedom, it's much more natural to work in a closed universe, which is S3. Or maybe I can say it's compactified as a torus, but then I have, it's a bit weird, the topology. But I could get rid of these boundary terms in a topological way. Thanks.